I'm Tobin Beck from Concordia University, and I'm here today with Phil Hendrickson, who is the librarian at Concordia. And good to see you, Phil.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Tobin.
So I want to start off by talking about what's going on with the library. And you have some other very interesting things that we'll talk about. But tell us what's going on here with the library.
Well, it's a time of lots of changes in the library world. As we kind of chatted about, it used to have a very print-centric, print-focused library world where research was pretty much done one way. And now information is scattered all over. Electronic, print, video, audio, all kinds of different media. And we can't be focused in the library on just being a warehouse of all the best things. We have to be focused on providing an environment where people explore and go searching to find things, and we're there to help them along the way.
Okay. So how do students do research now that's different from how they might have done it 10 or 20 years ago?
That's part of the irony, is that really the way they do research is about the same, but they don't think it's the same.
Hmm.
They think it's this novel thing. There's always new terms for things. We used to call it bibliographic instruction. Then there was research instruction, information literacy. The more recent term I've heard is information fluency. The concept is really the same, having to go and find sources and then analyze them to see if they're valid, if they are, you know, credentialed and quality resources, assess their point of view, assess, look for biases, things like that, and then figure out how to make the best use of them and use them appropriately. It's the same thing. The old saying that people laughed about was, if it's in the newspaper, it must be true. And we knew the converse, which was, you can't assume anything. You have to fact check. Well, now it's that famous quote from Abraham Lincoln saying, not everything on the internet is true.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah. So it's the same thing. You have to fact check. You know, you have to check your sources, check their biases, and so on. And so but it's such a broader landscape. And there's technology involved, all kinds of technologies involved in getting to the information now. So you have to be more fluent in those variety of techniques.
So how has that changed things for how you operate?
Well, we have to have a broader skill set. We have to have technology-based skills in our team, both for those who collect the information sources and make them available, and for those who do the more public end of teaching and helping people use this stuff. So that's extremely important.
Okay. And you're kind of well-positioned for that because you have a programming background?
It's ironic, but yes, I'm a computer programmer from my bachelor's degree, and that was my first career. But after a dozen or so years of doing that, I got out because I was tired of having to keep up with the fast pace of technological change. And it's ironic then that after a few years of looking into some other things, I got into library work, which now is fast-paced and involved in technological change.
Are students reading as much as they used to, in your opinion?
From my perspective, I'd say yes, they are, but differently. They're absorbing media from all different sources, listening to podcasts or, you know, music or online resources, but they do keep reading. And here at Concordia, we're a little bit more of a traditional university in the flow of life here. So I think the types of students that we get here are still more focused on, when they want to read something long, they'd rather have it in print. They'd rather have a book than an ebook,
mm-hmm,
as a generalization. But everybody finds their groove, finds their happy place. And for some people, they'll absorb everything on a screen. And other people would rather not do anything technology-based unless they're forced to. So, and that's true, I think, of pretty much all generations. It's not a generalization that all young people are tech-based and all, you know, old people are not. Everybody finds what works for them.
Okay. So we're able to bridge both.
We are, and I think people just have that innate ability with shorter items like journal articles and such, they're far easier to access electronically. Mm-hmm. They're indexed in a way that's far easier to get to them quickly. And so almost everyone will do that, will do that sort of research electronically. But then when they want to go deeply into a subject matter and read at length, most people would rather do that with a book than spending long time staring at a screen of text.
That's my preference. I like looking at, well, with journal articles, for example, I like looking at them online and then printing them out if I need to work with them. But they're certainly easier to save digitally than they are in a file cabinet. So you have a very interesting hobby that we talked about earlier. And you mentioned when you first came here to Concordia that ties in with your hobby by what one of the music professors asked you. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, when I first got here, one of the music professors said to me, well, we have a good music collection, except it's weak in jazz. And my immediate response was, no problem, I'll work on that. Because jazz has been a hobby of mine since high school. I have to say that's probably where I was introduced to it. But I played the drums and have since I was a child. And I love to do it. It's the one hobby I still have that I've had all my life since childhood. I tried to quit when I was in college. I thought, I don't have time for this. I'm going to go into computer stuff and so on. I tried to stop, but after one semester, I had a pair of sticks and I was beating on my desk and driving my roommates nuts. So I couldn't stop. We eventually got a band together with a roommate. And then I experienced what it's like to do music on your own terms instead of in the official school band led by, the faculty band director and such. And that was an eye-opening experience. And that's when I knew I would keep up with it as long as I could.
Okay. So you're still keeping up with it now, and let's talk about that.
So I play with a group out of Lincoln, Tim Javorski and the Jazz Cartel. Being the drummer, my nickname is the Hitman in the cartel. I guess that's my function.
Nice.
But we have fun. We play a couple of times a month around. Our leader does jobs all over the place, individually or with other groups. And in jazz, the typical setting is musicians tend to be freelance and conglomerations will come and go. You'll have a combination of musicians and you'll play together for a while, but you may freelance into other groups or other settings as opportunities, as playing engagements open up. So I've played with other groups and once in a while I've played under my own group's name. I tend to use the name Free Time Jazz when I have a group that I've put together. So, but it's fun. It's a great way to express your own musical ideas. I've had times in the past where I've played in wedding bands or cover bands, and you're expected to play songs the way the original sounds on the radio. So you have to get together, rehearse the song specifically, and try to get it fairly close to the original. Depending on the song, that can be easier or more difficult. But in jazz, it's more you just absorb the essence of the song if you're playing other people's compositions. And then you get together, you're on the same page with it, and you just start playing and see where it goes. And you may do something radically different than the original.
Now, there was a time we were talking about earlier when you thought you might want to be a professional jazz musician.
Well, it's funny. After I had realized that music was something I couldn't quit and how much I really enjoyed doing it, I felt like, let's explore the options. So many musicians, amateur musicians, will go through a period where you go to the music store and look for the sign on the bulletin board for people putting together a band. And of course, I went through times like that in my young adulthood, what people would call garage bands or whatnot. Played different styles, rock and roll, heavy metal, country, to lighter stuff, and tried all these different settings. Also, I'm a lifelong Christian, and that influenced the types of music that I wanted to be involved in. So when I say I played in a heavy metal band, actually, it was a Christian band that I played in for a while. That was an interesting experience because the point at which I started to realize I was not the right fit for the band was when I was trying to explain musical concepts to the guitarists, and they were irritated that I knew too much about music. And they told me to shut up. Said, maybe this isn't the best fit.
That's good. You also lived in Nashville for a while, and how did that influence your music?
That was interesting. So right after we got married, I married my wife in 1990. At the time, we were—
Your wife, Donna.
My wife, uh-huh. Donna. And we were in Des Moines, where we got married, and decided that I wanted to try to get into the Christian music industry. So this was at a point in contemporary Christian music where it was, I would say, flourishing within its own milieu. And so we decided to move to Nashville, which was the center of the Christian music industry. I was totally naive to how music industry worked, but being a computer programmer made moving easy because in that field, there's jobs everywhere. So literally, we looked for a couple of weeks, found a job, and moved down to Nashville. But down there, that is a serious music business town, and you have thousands, even tens of thousands of musicians in the city, and all of them are looking for their big break. Well, it's the ones who work the hardest and show their talent, develop it, and find the right settings that make their own breaks. And I wasn't that hungry. I had a good job. You know, I had a lovely wife. I was happy. I was just looking around the fringes. Had a few brushes with some professional players and some known Christian musicians, if you will. One or two of which I'm still in contact with, like, say, through Facebook and so on. But nothing really turned into anything substantial. Played with some different groups here and there, but nothing serious. And that's when I kind of realized that it wasn't my calling as a career. I had a career. It paid the bills. It made life smooth. So it was going to be a side light for me and still is.
Okay. So. And from Nashville, then you went to St. Louis.
We went to St. Louis because we realized we were Midwesterners at heart. And Nashville is a lovely town, but it was a little too far away from our family, and we wanted to move back to the Midwest. So we visited St. Louis. We found it a surprisingly nice place at the time and moved there, stayed there for, I think, 13 years. That's where our boys were born. So that's home for our boys. And we have fond memories of St. Louis and a lot of friends there.
And your boys are, their names are?
Our boys are Ian and Joshua, and they both attend Concordia here. Ian is in his fourth year. Josh is in his second year. They love it. They love it here in Seward. We've been here 9 years. And it was interesting to me. In St. Louis, I started finally playing some jazz, just built up my courage and said, I love the music. It's very expressive, a good way to play. So I just went out and found a couple of open jam sessions to sit in. And you basically raise your hand and say, can I play? And you get up on stage with professional or semi-professional musicians. And it was literally terrifying the first time. And the very first time that they called my, I went up and joined some professional. It turns out they were faculty members from Webster University. They were hosting this jam session. So top flight musicians. And they called a tune that I'd never heard before. And I said, okay, what is it? They kind of gave me a couple of ideas. And we just started playing. And it went fine. I didn't fall off the stool or throw anything. Nobody threw anything at me.
Didn't break a stick or anything.
No, and I was really surprised that what I was doing after I thought back on it was listening to the other players, listening to how the song was going as we were playing it, and adapting on the fly, providing something that worked. And it turns out that afterwards, you know, I got some very positive comments, some positive feedback from them that it was okay. And the original drummer from the house band, from the group, you know, had very complimentary remarks afterwards that he thought what I played fit well and so on. And I thought, oh, I can do this. So it's sort of those moments where you say you've been building all your life to this because you can't really prepare for the specifics. You're just relying on your instincts and all the other things that have prepared you for an occasion. And that's really what jazz is.
I was just thinking that, yeah, you're kind of, that's a description of jazz.
It is.
As a style of music.
Yeah, that's, you don't rehearse as much the specific song. It's more building up your skills, building up your musical vocabulary, and then having an open-ended conversation with the other musicians.
Wow, that's great. So what brought you from St. Louis to Seward?
Well, honestly, it was Concordia. At that point, I had a master's degree from the seminary in St. Louis, which was a sidelight that I thought I was going to do.
Was that while you were in St. Louis that you?
When I decided to move on from my technology career, I went and studied at the seminary, and halfway through realized it wasn't my calling to go into the ministry, but very much enjoyed learning the theology and finished a degree, a Master of Arts. So I'm not ordained or anything like that, but just have a graduate degree in historical theology from the seminary there, and then turned around after that and also did a library degree because I had started working as a student at the seminary library. And that's where I realized that groove fit me, the flow of library work, the way you're involved in preparing things and assisting other people to meet their goals. That felt very natural to me. So that made a good fit. I went on and got my library master's degree as well. And so with those degrees, it made me a good candidate to serve at one of the Concordia universities. And this opportunity came open at the right time for me. So that's, some people would call it fortune. I would, of course, call it God's will. But it's, the pieces fell into place and brought me here. From the feedback I've gotten from others, I feel like it's a good fit for my skills. Nobody's hounding me for the things that I'm not getting done. I like the fact that it's not life or death. I had a coworker in the technology fields that at one point in his past had worked on programming medical equipment, all the machines that go bing and beep in the hospital rooms. And there he said, yeah, if you have a bug in your program, it can kill somebody. I thought, that's a level of stress I don't want to deal with in my work. But no, I think in the library, I get to explore various interest areas, more so here at a university, say, than at the seminary in the past, which was great, but a little more narrowly focused, you know, here. I get to do jazz-related things. I get to do all kinds of different subject areas, history and geography, and to the sciences, to technology, to whatever. I get to dabble in them as, you know, a library director, and then explore and bring new things to light for people. That's kind of our goal in the library, is to help you answer the questions that you know you have, but maybe even expose you to things you're not aware of that seemed like a good fit
for you. That's terrific. You ever get the urge to play back in your office?
Well, I do have a practice pad in my office, but I don't usually get it out because that implies practicing, which I rarely do at this point in life. It's, for me, it's just so enjoyable to play with others that practicing on my own alone, it seems tedious.
Mm, yeah.
Sad to say, because I should. I know every time I play that my facility would be even better were I to have the discipline of regular practice. So don't do as I do. If there's any musicians listening out there, keep practicing and building up your facility. that allows you a greater vocabulary to use. But my vocabulary musically has always been based upon my familiarity with the music. So not to say I'm bad or unskilled as a player, but it's more, I think, the most important aspect of a musician is their ears. Mm-hmm. And being able to hear whether what they're doing is contributing well to the music and helping it be better.
So what advice would you have for students who are young, who maybe are just starting out exploring their interests? You have a wide range of interests. You've done a wide range of things. What sort of advice would you have for them?
Well, if we're talking life advice for somebody the age of an undergrad student, I would say don't put too much emphasis or lose too much sleep over the choices that you're making right now. Keep moving forward. If you aren't 100% sure that what you're studying is going to be your career for the rest of your life, that's okay. It probably won't be anyway. But keep making forward progress.
What would define that?
I'd say, you know, work. If you're at college, you want to work your way towards a degree. And if you're in your third year and you're thinking, well, this isn't the greatest thing, assess where you're at and decide, should I just go ahead and finish it so that I can get my foot out there into the real world? That's, I think, a lower risk path. It's a way to get started and then see where it goes. You'll have some credentials that show you can finish something and you can start in a field and adapt. I've worked in 4 different fields anyway, over the course of my career, I'd say. And
those
unrelated.
Four, what were the 4?
Well, there's computer programming. There's I have to count my theological side because I was studying that pretty heavily, trying to work into that. Then there was writing, which is what I did in between after I got out of the seminary. I was doing writing and editing work.
What kind of writing?
So I wrote some articles. I actually have a full draft of a novel that I wrote part of that during periods when I was unemployed, which is a good time to write. And, you know, I just different types of things like that, newsletter things to some online writing as well. And after I had graduated from the seminary, I went to work at the International Center, the LCMS headquarters, working in the communication department for World Relief and Human Care. So I did writing for their website. I did editing of some of the booklets and pamphlets and small publications that they had, that sort of communication work. And that was very interesting. But then when I was able to get back into library work, it felt much like a more complete fit for me.
No, that certainly makes sense with that rounded experience giving you perspective for the library work.
Yeah. And writing skill is definitely usable in any career. Mm-hmm. And I use it here, even just doing emails, which is a large part of being a director.
Yeah.
Send a ton of emails.
There's one other thing I want to touch on a little bit in our interview today, and that is your interest in board games. And that is, I think, really fascinating. So tell us a little bit about how that works.
We today live in an age that those in the board gaming hobby call it the golden age of board games, and people don't even realize it. But there are so many, literally 1,000 new board game designs coming out every year worldwide. It's a global phenomenon. And the design of them has improved radically over the very simple types of game designs that we might have played as kids in the 60s, 70s, 80s. Where more often than not, you would turn a card or roll some dice, move a piece around the board, and find out what happens to you. The modern design of board games is all about presenting an open field of choices and exploring that. So more often than not, you just have a wide open opportunity to do whatever you want. You have different mechanisms that limit how you take your choices. And it's like an intellectual puzzle. Each game is sort of a different shaped brain puzzle to explore. But the art and design of them is so much more engaging than the very simplistic things that we knew of as kids. So as an adult, you look at it on the table and it's this beautiful piece of art with wooden sculptured pieces and so on. It feels right. If we pulled out, you know, the game Sorry or something very simple and you put it on the table, it feels right to play it with your children, because it's just fun to spend time with your kids. But as an adult, it's so simplistic, the actions and the artwork and everything about it is very simple. It looks like a child's toy. The modern board games that you'd put out on the table have a wide array of themes and art styles that are phenomenal. And they definitely look like something appropriate for adults, which is how we've come to the point where now you have cafes and bars that are board game themed, that have libraries of hundreds, if not thousands, of games available for their patrons to come and play. That's kind of a new thing. The closest one I'd say is in Omaha. There's a place called Spielbound, Spiel being the German word for game. And that's the closest one here, but there are plenty of other ones around the country and around the world.
And here at the library at Concordia, you regularly host game nights for doing those types of board games.
We do. Once a month, second Saturday night of every month, we come back for a board game night after closing. And we go for 6 hours. We go from 6 to midnight to provide people the opportunity to explore a game space that, whether that's short or long. Some of the games are quick and fun and light and take 15 minutes to play. Others are a broader, deeper puzzle that you might spend 3 hours exploring it. And to have the opportunity to do that, we want to provide an open setting for that. It's turned out to be attractive because we're getting around 50 people every month that get together and do this. And they're not all people from Seward. We have people that come regularly from Lincoln, often from York, Beatrice, Omaha even. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
That sounds great. And I want to thank you for talking with me today. Again, this is Phil Hendrickson, the library director at Concordia University in Seward. I'm Tobin Beck. Thanks for listening.